use any other, any techniques?
I think I used phonics because of the pronunciation that was, I don't know how people teach reading without phonics or pronunciation. And so I don't even remember the textbooks. I don't recall what the textbooks were at all.
But they had textbooks.
Yes, there were some textbooks. And but mostly we tried to get things in a conversational thing. So and get past how are you, I am fine, you know, try to get into more complex conversations. So what I often would do was pick a subject for that day's discussion and then gear the conversation using that particular subject. I'm trying to think of one that I might have used. I can't think of anything specifically, but maybe like at home, and then talk about the different rooms in the house and having breakfast and lunch and dinner and sort of, you know, putting it together so that there would be an introduction of pronunciation, new vocabulary, and it would have, it wouldn't just be out there, it would have some context to it. And but I worked that out on my own. I mean, that was not part of our, I don't remember any specific educational techniques that we were taught during the time. We were all education, we were all teachers, you know, if in some way or another.
Did you have staff meetings where you tried to share whatever experience you had in the
I don't remember that. We probably, but we didn't get down to Saigon very often. We were pretty much...
No, I mean, in the, amongst the teachers in your school.
Oh.
Did, like, for example...
No. No, not some in did. My school. No, yeah. And... I don't remember anything like that at all. We did have social get-togethers with the other teachers, but I don't remember staff meetings.
Have you been able to keep in touch with any of the teachers? Or
no, I lost all of them when Saigon fell in 75, and they all scattered to the wind. And I have not located any of them. Like I say, I had a couple students that called me earlier this year, which I was so delighted about. And one of the things that was, I think, is really interesting, and it's a little bit off the subject, but it's about Vietnamese people and keeping in touch. When I moved here in 1986, that was in the fall, and that summer, Billie Lee came to visit. And she always reads phone books because she's always looking for lost Vietnamese friends, and that's one of her things. So she... hadn't been able to sleep that night, so she, our guest room is also an office, and so she got the Yellow Pages, and she found the name of Nguyen Hy Vaughn. And so Saturday morning when she got up, she said, "Betty, I think I found Vaughn." And Vaughn was the president of the youth, the Vietnamese youth organization in Saigon, and we were all really, really good friends. I mean, talk about connecting. We really, really connected well with Vaughn. I did, and so did Billie Lee. And so she says, "You know, I think he's in this area." And she says, "Actually, I think he's in Edmonds." And I said, "Oh," I said, "that's impossible. It must not be the right person." So we tried to call, and there was no one home. So we waited until that evening, and we called. And Billie Lee called, and she said, "Is this Nguyen Hy Vaughn?" And he said, "Yes." And she said, "This is Billie Lee." He said, "Well, Billie Lee, where are you? How are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm at Betty's." "Oh, you're at Betty's. Where does Betty live?" Well, he lives a block from here, one block from here in Edmonds, Washington. Now, talk about an incredible chance, 25 years, and we're neighbors. If you walk out this front door, and if you could go straight through the block instead of having to go up and go around, he lives 2 minutes from here. And so that was just a wonderful, wonderful thing to find him and his family. And we are fast friends and see each other all the time. We always go out to dinner and visit, you know, back and forth. And that has been truly, to me, Ripley's Believe It or Not, incredible thing.
And he was head of the...
Vietnamese Youth Organization.
And that's the one that coordinated Saigon
I think
Ejects
so,
and
yeah.
The villages
yeah.
and things like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, his name was Nguyen
Hy
Vanh.
I'd love to meet him someday.
Yes.
I'll be back here in January, by the
way. Ah, okay.
So we're having the American Historical
well,
Association
maybe
meeting, so maybe we can meet.
Make arrangements. He's very, very nice. His wife is absolutely charming. She is not the reticent, quiet. She has those qualities, but
mm-hmm.
it is not all that she is. And she's a very. She taught at the School of Pedagogy in Saigon. She taught French, and she is outgoing. She's has run a furniture store since they've been here. She has. You know, she's just a wonderful person.
What does he do?
Vaughn is, he was an architect in
mm-hmm.
Vietnam, and he, since he's been in the States, he's owned a Vietnamese grocery store, he which he did very well. Then he had a furniture store up in Everett,
mm-hmm.
which just burned down last year. Not burned down, when we had that big snow at Christmas time,
mm-hmm.
The whole building collapsed.
Mm-hmm.
And was the end of that business.
Mm-hmm.
And now he is managing his brother is a medical psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
and so he is managing the office for his brother that is involved in this medical clinic that he's involved at. And
amazingly resourceful, isn't it?
Oh, very.
From architect to
yes to grocer to furniture
yes.
store. Yeah, and
Americans are agonizing over downsizing
yeah.
because they might have to once
change their jobs. Right,
yes.
I understand. And so, and they have a son who had spinal meningitis as a baby, and who now has a hearing loss. He's lost about 60%.
That the only
that's their only child.
Well, that's great.
And
the only problem. That
oh yes,
well,
and he's
that's
going
good
to
in that sense. Yeah.
yeah, he's going to Rochester
mm-hmm.
Institute of Technology
mm-hmm.
and going through a computer program there,
mm-hmm.
and so he's doing his son
great.
Is doing very well. And what's interesting is his son is like 6'1". And,
American food.
That's you know we were talking
yeah.
about that the other day, and we said, boy, I said these tiny Vietnamese people are going to become less tiny. As nutrition and the proper vitamins and all this sort of thing get into their system, because Chung is 6'1", and for Vietnamese, you know, that's just
well. Japanese height, average height, is rising because they're taking on
huh?
and it's having an enormous effect on the average height.
Right.
Whereas our average height isn't really much changing at all.
No,
so,
no.
Very interesting.
Yeah, but anyway, so that is a really special thing that Thuy and Vaughn and Chung are here in Edmonds, and that we have been able to keep that
touch.
Connection and keep in touch.
And you knew him in Saigon.
I met him like the second day I was in Saigon.
Because he was the director of
right.
that program.
And you know, we used to run around. He and a friend of his name was Bao. He lives in Switzerland now. Billy Lee and I used to get on their Vespas or their motorcycles, and we'd run all over Chulan and all over Saigon, you know. And I mean, we were personal friends as well as colleagues through
okay.
through IVS.
Did you ever did you have a summer where you did a summer program for one summer? And they usually
mm-hmm.
try to assign IVS or some kind of summer project. And I wonder.
I don't recall that we ever did anything. I know that in the spring we went to Japan,
mm-hmm.
and on our vacation or
mm-hmm.
leave or whatever R&R, and but I don't remember any kind of a summer program at all. We were just doing our thing, whatever. But don't forget, we were the first. We were really early, so they hadn't figured
oh, that's
out.
True.
You
that's
know,
true. They may not have had those.
They
programs,
hadn't
yeah.
figured this out yet.
Right.
I don't think
mm-hmm.
That it was a necessity, because we went up to Hue.
Mm-hmm.
We went up to Hue, and then we came down on that highway in an old touring car with running boards that looked like
mm-hmm.
it looked like a 20s hoodlum, you know, Chicago gangster car, with a Jeep with a machine gun emplacement in front and a Jeep with a machine gun emplacement in back, and there maybe were 10 cars in the convoy,
mm-hmm.
and we came down from Hue to Da Nang.
Mm-hmm.
And
beautiful ride. Over
it was
that.
A gorgeous ride. And
Bond,
we had been up in Hue with Bon, and I can't remember. There were three or four of us that were up there,
mm-hmm.
and we had stayed on a sandpan and went up the Perfume River to the tombs of Ming Mong,
mm-hmm.
back and then took this car trip. And I had just gotten to know Fred fairly well about that time. So when I came back to Queen Yan and he said, "Well, what did you do?" And I told him all about this drive, and he said, "Oh my God! How could you have done that? That was really not the safest thing in the world." I said, "Well, we had machine guns in front and in back. It seemed like it was okay."
Yeah, well, and it was probably.
Yeah.
But that pass, there was even a battalion that was over, an American battalion, which was overrun in that pass.
Oh, really?
And eventually they stationed, I think it was the 503rd of the 101. It was denuded of, there was nothing there.
Nothing, huh?
And so it's amazing how you always ask, where were you and when were you? Because everything, you know.
Right. Well, in 62, different. It would have probably been 63 by then. It was beautiful, and you know, and then we got down to Da Nang, and we went up through Marble Mountain. We climbed to the top of Marble. As I recall, we had to go through some caves or something to get up to the top of Marble Mountain. And so, you know, everything I did in Vietnam, from my narrow point of view, was very positive. Was very enlightening. It was.
What did
good
you do
experience.
In the evenings when you weren't? If you weren't at the PX or having dinner with the
well, we only did that once in a while.
Yeah, that's true.
And we weren't at, there was no PX. I mean.
So you lived off the local economy.
We lived off the economy except for scotch and cigarettes. And we taught English. We organized night classes and we taught professionals English. We had like the high school principal, nurses, doctors, administrator, people that were in the local government, and I think we had maybe 6 or 8 students in one class, and they would come to our house in the evening. We'd sit around in the living room and we'd have conversation. Again, we'd work on a certain sound, or you know, we'd have some kind of structure, some type of a.
So it was about 4 nights a week.
Yeah, about 4 nights a week.
And you worked from about.
Well, we worked from 8, as I recall, 8 till. 12, and then I recall that there was a siesta from 12 to 3, and then class was from 3 to 5 or 3 to 6, I can't remember. And then we'd come home, and of course we had a cook and a housekeeper. We had one servant, and she was wonderful. She was like, she adopted us like we were her kids. And so her name was Baba. That's what we called her. I don't know what her, you know, real name was. Billy Lee knows, but I don't remember now. And so she was our cook, and she took care of us when we were sick. And she'd tell me if she liked this guy or she didn't like that guy, you know. And Fred was the only one she really liked. The rest of them, you know, she'd tell me, "Oh, he's no good," or "I don't like the way his face is," or, you know, she would always give me.
Well, she had obviously good.
You know, and but Fred she really liked, and so anyway, so she was more than just our cook in our house. She was like our mother, our surrogate mother, you know. And so anyway, so she would do all the cooking, and our cooking was incredible. She had it was a cement platform that was counter height, and there was 2 holes in it for charcoal. And I think there was a bare light bulb. The whole thing was black with charcoal smoke. A little tiny window up someplace. This was a room. This was separate from the main house. And she would come out with these fantastic dinners. I mean, it was incredible. We had a refrigerator, and that was in the house. And so she would come up with these wonderful dinners. And so when the people came in the evening for classes. We'd always have iced tea or, you know, something like that. And she'd have some little cookies or little snack things and everything. So it was a social, it was social in one sense, because it wasn't set up like a classroom with me in front. It was set up like in a living room situation where people would sit in chairs. And so we did that about 4 days a week, 4 nights a week.
So like me, you get paid essentially 10 cents an hour.
Oh, the money was never...
No, I mean when you amortize.
Oh, yes.
What you're being paid over the
full
day that you put in. But that does give that gives a very good impression of just how much time, because almost everybody did that.
Yeah.
Because they didn't just work, you know, in a classroom and then go home and then
no.
do nothing.
No, you were totally immersed in the Vietnamese community. I was, and Billy Lee was. We certainly did other things, like we would be invited out to the officers' club and that type of thing. But But we were totally immersed in the Vietnamese community. We went to parties, we went to dinners. They always invited us for Tet. You know, we had these big Tet celebrations.
Were you there for two celebrations?
I remember one, mm-hmm. and I don't know. I probably was there for two, because mm-hmm. I didn't leave until the fall of 63 is when I left.
Was Ngo Dinh Diem still alive when you left?
Mm-hmm. As I remember, yeah. And
too bad, because the Vietnamese reactions to his assassination are very interesting.
Oh.
And, well, others say they loathed him, but they loved President Kennedy.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, it's so sad that we're happy our president's dead,
our president's dead.
And it would have been interesting to see, you know, had they spoken to you, but of course we won't know.
No.
On the other hand, you know, it's all anecdotal. It doesn't mean anything.
No, but anyway, so it was... we were very busy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we never sat around and wondered what to do. It was a very active, a very busy, and a very enjoyable time. And money never was an issue at all. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you were really living. And when you have that sort of, you have that feeling that you're making a contribution mm-hmm. and that you're doing what you want to do, and you're with people that you enjoy, money is not an issue at all. You know, so I think we got paid $80 a month that went into our checking account back in the States, and then we had a cost of living, as I recall. Mm-hmm. That's the way it was.
Something
and
like that.
So they paid our rent, and they paid for our cook. One of the things that I do remember is that I got dengue fever,
mm-hmm.
and I was really, really sick with that. I had to go down to Saigon because I was so sick. And have you heard of, I'm sure you have, Vaughn and Jerry Stapleton? Do you know their names?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he was like our team leader,
mm-hmm.
and Vaughn has passed away mm-hmm. Now. He's not alive anymore, but his wife still is.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were the team leaders. I think they were the education team. And
what was Vaughn's wife's name?
Jerry. Mm-hmm. And Stapleton. And so I went down. What happened is I was so sick. We were staying at a house on Le Van Zwet. No.
Mm-hmm.
No, Yendo Street, I remember that. Big, big house. And I was so sick. And violent headaches, and I mean, just every bone in my body.
Bone break fever?
Yeah. And so I thought, well, you know, the Seventh-day Adventist Hospital was the hospital that most people in IVS went to.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought, well, you know, I may be dying, so I'm going to see if I can get into this military hospital. So I went over to the military hospital, and I'm sure that somebody went with me. I don't think I was by myself. Anyway, and I don't know what I said, but I got admitted. Probably because I spoke English fluently, right? I don't know. So anyway, so then they figured out that I wasn't supposed to be there. But in the meantime, they had diagnosed my problem and everything, you know. So Jerry and Vaughn came and got me and took me to their home. And I was in bed a month,
mm-hmm.
and I was, you know, as I said, I was really sick. But the thing that the bathroom that had the shower in it was the bathroom off my bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a little suite.
Mm-hmm.
And so all the people that came to take showers, because I don't remember what the problem was. Maybe the water at the IVS house was, they were having trouble. I can't remember all that. But there was a steady stream of people coming, sitting on the foot of my bed, chatting with me as they were waiting for their turn in the shower. And so I was, it was a very comfortable convalescence, because I certainly wasn't bored, because I had all these people. It was sort of like Grand Central Station, you know. And
this
so,
is at the Stapleton's house?
At the Stapleton's house.
And where
house
was that in relation?
In Saigon.
But it was in a street. You already actually mentioned the name of it. Yeah.
No, the street that, Yendo Street, uh-huh. is where the IVS house was that I lived in. It
right.
wasn't an IVS house like the one that was
right.
out in Le Van Zwet.
Right. Uh-huh.
It wasn't that. It was, we were in the city.
Mm-hmm.
And their house, I don't recall, just, you know, where it would have been. I don't have any recollection.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so I stayed there. And then when I finished my convalescence there, then I went...
At the Stapleton's.
At the Stapleton's.
Right.
Then I went back to Quy Nhon.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got off the plane in Queen Yan, Billy Lee and Fred and another man were there to meet me, and that was the first time I met Fred.
Uh-huh.
And the other guy's name, his name was Harry, and he was the scotch and the cigarette procurer.
Right, yeah.
And he was going back to the States. He was rotating back to the States,
uh-huh.
and Fred was his replacement.
Uh-huh.
So he said to Fred, you know, hey, you're not doing anything. Come on out to the airport. Betty's coming in.
Uh-huh.
You get to meet her and you know, and everything. And so that was my the first time that I met Fred was when I got off the airplane after having this illness.
Did you have an initial impression of Fred when you got off the airplane?
He was a nice guy, but I hadn't seen Harry in 2 months. And
right.
so I was, you know, polite, but not of, but I didn't know him. It would be like if I saw you and we knew each other
right.
and you had a friend
right.
and hi, John, how are you?
Right.
And then you and I would get into this conversation, you know. So it was a positive, but not like wham or anything like that. It was, you know, Fred and I were friends for a long time before we ever became romantically involved, which was, I think, the reason why we're still married 34 years, because we really knew each other as people prior to becoming involved romantically, and I liked him. He'd be my best friend if I didn't love him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is, I think, one of the reasons that we have had such a fortunate life together.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
You dated you knew each other as friends, you dated a little bit. And did he surprise you by asking you?
No, actually what happened is he went down to Saigon as liaison officer for the battalion that he was connected to. And
he was a helicopter pilot.
He was a helicopter pilot, right. And he went down there as a liaison officer so that things that were coming in for their company, he'd make sure that they got up to Queen Yan and stuff. And he was gone like 6 months, and I didn't miss him. Because he was just a nice guy that I knew, and so on and so forth. And then when I went to, Billy Lee and I went to Japan in April of 63, we came back and we were strolling down the main street there by the Continental Hotel, and I can't
even think.
In Saigon. Yeah. And I heard this voice and it said, Betty and Billy Lee. And we turned around and there was Fred. And I said, well, how are you? He said, fine. And he said, do you have time? I'll buy you a drink. So we went to one of those little bird watching cafes, street things, and had a gin and tonic and chatted about what we'd all been doing in the last 6 months. And then things just went from there. He called and said, would you like to go to the officers club swimming? I was at the house out in Les Vents Wet. And I said, Billy Lee, and I'd love to. I was so used to doing that. And then at the last minute, she couldn't come.
It's fate.
It was fate, you know. And so he and I went out, and that was April, 18th of October, we were married. So it was not a long time from our second meeting to the time that we got married. It was a matter of 5 months or something like that. But I had had this history with him prior
to
that.
Then he was going to be rotated home.
He was being sent back to the States, and neither one of us felt like we wanted to be separated for that long length of time. And I think in his heart of hearts that he didn't want to go back to Fort Benning, Georgia, and say his fiance was in Vietnam.
It would have looked
supposed
bad.
To, supposed to
yes.
be the other way around,
right? Could have used some of the gender bending there, though.
But he doesn't necessarily admit that.
And so did you just communicate with IVS in Saigon and tell them that?
Yeah, that I was going to be leaving, and I had to pay my own way back home.
Because you weren't finishing your contract.
I hadn't finished my contract, which
right.
Fred paid for, because I didn't have any money. I'd just spent it all in Japan, and. So I came back to the States, and he met me in San Francisco, and that was that. We were married October.
But he finished up his military service in Alabama.
No, in Georgia.
In Georgia. Oh, I mean in Georgia.
Yeah.
And then what did you do?
We went to Nepal. And
why did you go to Nepal?
Well, because we both loved living overseas, and we both. I would never have married anybody that didn't have any sense of adventure or had any that was intrepid about life. I mean, I would never have gotten involved with anybody on that level. So we had very much in common the fact that we wanted to see the world and travel. And
what did you do there?
In Nepal? I taught at the American School.
Okay, so you applied for a job.
Once I was in country.
Once you were in country. So you just decided, why did you choose Nepal, by the way?
Because that's where Fred got a job.
Fred was doing...
flying. He was flying fixed wing in helicopters.
For Continental?
At this time it was a company called Air Ventures Incorporated. Mm-hmm. And what they did is they had a contract with the government, the United States government, and they flew USAID, World Health, they flew all the people that were involved, embassy. He took Ellsworth Bunker and Luce is her first or last name.
Claire Booth Luce.
When they got married,
right,
he took them on their honeymoon down to Tiger Tops, and he got to know Sir Edmund Hillary. And so in Nepal, there's a north-south road, but there's not a lot of east-west roads. And I'm sure the things have changed considerably since then, but you couldn't really go anyplace without some type of air transportation.
And he not only flew helicopters, but he trained in fixed wings.
He was both. He flew both of them. So he flew the Pilatus Porter, which is a short takeoff and landing. And then he also flew helicopters. So he worked for Air Ventures, and Air Ventures had the government contract to take everybody out and about and do stuff.
And you taught in the
American
School.
And I taught at the American School.
And how long were you in Nepal?
A year. And Air Ventures lost their contract. And so then... we decided we would, well, let's see, how did that go? We ended up in the Bahamas, and I think we were in the Bahamas because we hadn't been out of the States 18 months, and we didn't want to get caught up in that tax situation, and so we figured we might as well spend it in the Bahamas than just write a check to the government.
IRS,
So off to the Bahamas we went. Then Fred got a job through the same people that had been involved with Air Ventures, in Laos with Continental Air Services. And Continental Air Services was ran the same type of operation that Air America did, except for it was a much smaller much smaller operation. And so he flew there, and then he lost his hearing in one ear because of his exposure to high frequency sound for 20 some years. And so then he became the director of flight operations. He stayed
for Continental,
and he stayed on in the administrative end of it. And then we left there in 72, and we loved it. Absolutely, everything about all those years overseas was really
Where did you live in Laos?
In Vientiane.
And you mentioned that one day you went over to the IVS.
Right, I went
IVS
over.
IVS house in Vientiane.
Shortly after I arrived, you know, you have, I mean, you know, I didn't know anybody in IVS there, but I mean, you feel like a kindred spirit. It's just like, I'm sure if you meet somebody and you find out they're IVS, you feel like they're your sister, your brother, practically, because of common experiences that you've had. So I just went over there, and I know there was a man, and I don't recall all of the circumstances, but I went over and introduced myself, and it was like, oh yeah, sure, I'm busy, goodbye. And because I had so many other things that I was involved in, I just never went back. And that is probably something that I would wish I had, because I would have gotten to know June and other people, you know, much sooner than I did.
And you taught at the international school?
No, in Vietnam, or in Laos, I taught, I had a private school. And the high school in the... American high school there only went through the 10th grade. And if you were a junior or senior in high school, you had to go to relatives back in the States, or you had to go to boarding school, or you had to try to take correspondence courses on your own. Well, if you've ever done correspondence courses, you know that it takes a lot of motivation for people to stay on track, because, and for teenagers, you know, you're almost talking impossible. And so what... Fred had been married before, and he had a son, a 16-year-old son, that came to Laos for 2 weeks and stayed 2 years. And so, and he was a senior. He was just going to start his senior year in school. And so we looked into the University of Nebraska home study courses.
So you helped them through.
And so I said, well, now if we're in this situation, there has to be other people that are in this situation. So in the Kao Lao, which was the English language paper in the American community, mm-hmm. I put an ad, or just a little blurb, it wasn't an ad really, that I was going to be tutoring, and ended up with like 9 or 10 students. Mm-hmm. And my friend was a science and math teacher. Mm-hmm. So I could handle the English, and I could do the history, and I could do your social studies type courses. Mm-hmm. She could do the math, the chemistry, and that mm-hmm. type of thing. So the two of us combined efforts, and we did that for 4 years.
Mm-hmm. And you left Laos in 72.
72.
And you came back to the States? Or? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, came back to the States, to Montana.
And to Montana, and mm-hmm. what did you do in Montana?
Died. You...
Did Fred have a job there?
No, he was retiring. This was the, he felt that that was the end of his, because he couldn't fly anymore
because
of his hearing situation. Right. He was ready to retire. Mm-hmm. And of course, he had retired from the military 10 years earlier, mm-hmm. you know. And
he looks in terrific shape because he must be older.
He's Fred's 70.
Yeah, he looks good.
Yeah, oh yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's because he married me.
That's right. And you left Montana, but so you were going to retire to Montana.
Right.
That didn't work out, so you moved to...
Seattle.
And you've been
but
there.
But we were in Montana 11 years. Uh-huh. I mean, it wasn't like we were there 6 months. Mm-hmm. The problem was coming back to the States, mm-hmm. Which I since have found out that that was not an unusual situation. Mm-hmm. But at the time, I thought...
We're talking just now about coming back to the States and how it seemed like a different world.
Oh, it was very, very difficult transition. I was in Florence, Italy 1 week, and Florence, Montana the next. I have to tell you, Florence, Montana was at that time was a gas station and 3 bars. And but the reason we went to Montana is because my husband said to me, "Where would you like to live?" And I very innocently said, "I don't care. Wherever you want to." And he said, "Well, I was in Montana once 30 years ago or 20 years ago, and I've always wanted to go back because I remember it as being so green and so beautiful, and oh, let's go to Montana." And I said, "Okay." And I didn't realize what I had agreed to. And as it turned out, in retrospect, it was a very, very good decision because it changed. Here was another point that changed my whole life. And because I could not get a job teaching. My initial plan was to go back to school, get my master's degree, or go into counseling or administration, high school, mm-hmm. Principal, whatever. And I couldn't even get a job teaching in Montana because I had too many years teaching experience and they could not afford to hire me. And apparently there is a state law that says you can only deduct so many years off your teaching experience. It left me at too high a level because the University of Montana is right there and they can hire graduates mm-hmm. from the university at a first entry level rather than hire somebody that has had 5, 6, 8. So anyway, so I was quite devastated. And one of the things that I missed about coming back to the States was the sense of adventure. There was no longer waking up in the morning and wonder who you were going to mm-hmm. meet, mm-hmm. What you were going to see. It was homogenized as far as I was concerned, and I didn't like that, and I still don't like that. I mean, that's not something that I will go out of my way to create situations that have more of a sense. And so that was part of the problem. There was no sense of adventure. There was no excitement. There was no thrill of the moment. You weren't living on the edge. There wasn't a question of, well, tomorrow there could be a coup. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, there was not that you wanted that to happen. That's not the point at all. But the point is that you never really could predict or really know how the next 24 hours may or may not be. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the United States, it was pretty, I mean, given, you know, certain exceptions, is pretty predictable. I mean, you don't know when you're going to die.
Well,
so.
Certainly in Montana.
Yes. And the other problem was is that they had never heard that the Depression was over in Montana, and I had a very, very hard time dealing with all the junk cars in the yard. The whole mental mindset is mm-hmm. completely different than mine, mm-hmm. and it doesn't mean it's wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that, but it was just that I was a fish out of water. Mm-hmm. I just did not belong in Montana. But the good part, and there were many, many good parts, is that we made some wonderful friends. It took me much longer to make friends in Montana than any place I'd ever lived, mm-hmm. but that was because I couldn't talk about living overseas. I couldn't talk about anything I had ever done in college or classes that I had done, because most of these people couldn't, either weren't interested or didn't relate. Mm-hmm. And so to find people that were interested, I mean, so that meant I had to go back to high school. There was nothing I could talk about. and I wasn't really interested in discussing my high school days as a regular subject, you know. And so you had to be really careful. Like if you would have said, well, the last time I was in Hong Kong, it sounded pretentious. Mm-hmm. And that's not who I am or where I am, but it was just my life. Mm-hmm. And so it took a long time to make friends in Montana, that I could find people that had done some traveling, that you could talk about different experiences and that you had something in common with on a day-to-day basis. But that did happen, and we made some absolutely wonderful friends. And I got out of education mm-hmm. because I couldn't stay in it. I mean, it wasn't really a question of choice at all. And I went to an auction, and I was invited by a mutual friend, and from that point on, I never looked back. I knew that I was headed in a different direction.
And
so as a personal property appraiser, I went into interior design, and then I went into antiques, mm-hmm. and 10 years ago, I went through the whole study program that the International Society of Appraiser has, became mm-hmm. a certified appraiser, mm-hmm. and now I go into homes. I went into a home the other day and mm-hmm. saw some Rod A baskets.
Mm-hmm. And really?
Yeah. And
that's,
I said
R A
D E something no, like no. that.
Yeah, it is R A D E. Yeah. They're Montagnard. Or
yeah,
tribe
right
of
there there's one sitting uh-huh. by the fireplace.
Yeah, that's how I noticed it.
And I said to this guy, "Oh, you were in Vietnam. These are Montagnard baskets, the Rod A tribe." And he said, "How do you know that?" You see, so the point is that all of these experiences mm-hmm. have culminated in a career that I just absolutely love.
Well, how
love.
Much is it worth?
I haven't found any comparables, right, but I would guess that we were probably talking in the $150 range. Mm-hmm. That would be my guess. Obviously, it didn't. I mean, an IVA salary, it didn't even cost anything close to
well,
that
well,
when
it didn't
I
cost
was
them.
At
yes,
that time,
true.
Right? And so anyway, so I love what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. I get to do research, which I thoroughly enjoy. Mm-hmm. I get to meet people. I get to have beautiful things around me, and I don't have to own them. Mm-hmm. And I'm no longer interested in accumulating, as mm-hmm. you can see from what we have
here.
Oh, when
you ever feel like divesting, please let me know. But
what we have here, we certainly yeah. don't have any need for accumulating anymore. So I'm past that stage. Mm-hmm. Oh, I do pick up something occasionally, but mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not an avaricious
right.
collector any longer.
Yeah, I try not to buy as many books as I used
right.
to.
Well, books now,
my
that's
trunk
a different
is filled
story.
With, my trunk is, however, I said, however,
yes.
my trunk is filled with books that I've
yes.
been buying on this trip.
Yes.
When you... thinking about IVS organization,
uh-huh.
Is there something you could say that, you know, that...
As far as living in country and
yeah,
the administration... Okay,
yeah.
What didn't work is at that time, and I'm sure it would not even be an issue today, was the difference between the needs of women and the difference in the needs of men. For mm-hmm. instance, I was telling you about the time I had dengue fever. Mm-hmm. So when I came back, we said we want screens on our windows. Mm-hmm. And they were appalled. I mean, they said, "Screens? Nobody in IVS has screens. We don't need screens." And I said, "We need screens. I just got over this awful thing, and I'm not planning on getting malaria or whatever else mm-hmm. might come from mosquitoes." And so they did pay to have the house screen, but it was not an easy, smooth, I mean, it was smooth enough mm-hmm. because, but they were reluctant mm-hmm. to do that. So there were little things that I'm sure they were a difficulty because it was the first time,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily one that perpetuated itself into the future. Mm-hmm. And I think what they did that was very good, and I think that is that they let us all figure out how to make things work for ourselves without giving us all these instructions or ideas. You know, like when we got to Qunyang, like I say, it was like figuratively they dropped us from a parachute, mm-hmm. And we had to figure it out ourselves. But you see, that was good because if we weren't the kind of people that could figure things out by ourselves, we wouldn't have been there in the first place. I can't see some insipid, wishy-washy person going to Vietnam in the 60s. I mean, I just don't see that. They let us figure out things for ourselves, and I think that was good. We never felt a strong support from side. There were times that probably bothered us, but it was not anything that I recall now as any specific problem. We were attached. There was an umbilical cord there, but it wasn't very strong,
mm-hmm.
and I think that basically was really good, because as I say, they let us figure out how to make things work for ourselves, and that was fine. And I enjoyed the Vietnamese people. I enjoyed living in Vietnam. I enjoyed my work. IVS was almost secondary. Does that make sense to you? I mean,
sure.
In other words, it was there, and we knew that it was there, and it was like the safety net,
mm-hmm.
sort of thing, but it wasn't very dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And probably because they were used to doing that with all the men,
mm-hmm.
and so they didn't think in any terms of making any changes.
Yeah, no, the advantage of them not just assuming that the women would do the same thing that
right.
men was.
Yeah, I think that was good. Yeah, see, and that part of it, I think that was fine. But it never gave, I don't know, I think that women somehow connect emotionally and connect differently than men do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they never gave us that kind of connection that women would have with other women.
Mm-hmm.
It was just sort of, and which was not necessarily bad, but it wasn't warm and fuzzy,
mm-hmm.
if that make any sense. And so I think of my experience in Vietnam as extraordinarily positive, but I see IVS itself,
mm-hmm.
as far as the on-site people and things, as a secondary, not
mm-hmm.
as a primary. For that whole
would have
positive
made it,
experience.
Would it make a difference if there was a team leader for educationists, for example?
No, I don't know if that would have, I think it was not the gender part as much as it was hold the mindset in the, I mean, these guys were out trucking around in rice paddies,
mm-hmm.
and
actually that's not what I meant. I meant, I found recently, because I took a group to India,
uh-huh.
that many of the women were reluctant to go with the female
team. I see.
Team
I see what you're talking about.
Rather than what
about.
They actually did, I think what they did worked out. As far as I mean, but we haven't
right.
interviewed enough women to determine whether that's
at
true.
At that time, there were only three of us.
But there were only three, so
there's not
right,
a lot of women to
right.
to interview.
But it's interesting, something to think.
I don't know. When Jerry and Vaughn Stapleton came
mm.
on, and I don't remember how much later that was. They weren't there when we arrived. There
mm-hmm.
was, you know, it was just the three of us women
mm-hmm.
that were there. It was easier to talk to to Jerry and Vaughn than it was to Don Luce or
mm-hmm.
Mike Chilton or Jim Kelly,
mm-hmm.
or who were all really nice people.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't have a connection.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how to explain that. It, there just wasn't that kind of connection that you felt comfortable chit-chatting.
What did Vaughn Stapleton do before he came?
I think he was a high school principal.
Okay,
he was
so
either a teacher or a high school principal.
That may be a difference because
right.
because Mike and
they were all
and Jim Kelly and everything. They were all
See, I mean, we just had so many. Our life experiences
mm-hmm.
were so different that it was just really hard to make any kind of connection. And
mm-hmm.
that certainly doesn't, I mean, I think of them all
oh,
as
no,
being
it has
nice
nothing
guys.
To do with that.
Yeah,
no,
right.
it's just an interesting circumstance.
Yeah.
That it's part of the historical process of
If you have any common experience, then it gives you a connection. When you don't have common experiences, you don't. Now, see, if I met any of these guys today, I would have common experience because we shared Vietnam.
No, not only that, but they've
And they're also matured, and I have too.
And
I
they've all brought in their experiences beyond that.
Yeah.
I mean, they all did. They didn't go back to the farm.
Yeah, right. See, so I mean, so it would be like best friends meeting. My God, I haven't seen you in 30 years, and what have you been doing, and all this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But at the time, there was not that kind of connection. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I really enjoyed what I did. Mm-hmm. I appreciated the opportunity to go to Vietnam mm-hmm. and do all those things. But IBS as a group mm-hmm. Is not at the top. It's at the next level.
Mm-hmm. What were your emotional, how did you feel emotionally when the war ended in 75?
I was living in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
I think depression.
Mm-hmm.
Some anger to some extent. Was it all for? You know, why did we even go through this? And then, of course, after we saw the awful things that happened in Vietnam and other areas of the Southeast, losing the war was inexcusable. Just, you know, I mean, to have allowed that to happen just really ticked me off. And I think we did allow it to happen. There was no reason why we had to lose that war.
And did you think back, when you look back at IVS, could it have...
It goes back to my philosophy of if you are the best person you can be mm-hmm. and do what you can to make the world a better place in a very small personal way, I'm not talking about any grandiose mm-hmm. kind of things, then you're making a contribution. And I think every person that I knew in IVS was doing the best that they knew how to make things work for the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, well, on a personal level, it was my students that I talked to last month were so happy to be in touch with me and how important it was that they had had that ability,
mm-hmm.
that opportunity to learn English because it became such an important part of their a requirement in their lives as they as they left the country. But yeah, I would say that IVS, it was on a personal level, not on a each one of those people whose lives that you touched in a positive manner, it was
mm-hmm.
like throwing a pebble in the water
mm-hmm.
and the rings just go out and go out and go out. And and I think that it is much more personally rewarding to be able to work one-on-one and or with a classroom of people than to try to in the positions that we were in. We weren't
mm-hmm.
diplomats. I mean, you know, that was not, we weren't involved in international intrigue and all that sort of thing. In our position, we did an excellent job in communicating our value system and what's important in helping people learn and sharing.
Are you a member of the IVS Alumni Association?
Mm-hmm.
And contribute money to the IVS?
Not strongly, no.
Mm-hmm. And have you attended a reunion?
Mm-hmm.
Is there, IVS people, former IVS volunteers, you are in best contact.
Lily Langley, instead, Christmas time, kind of, you know, Christmas cards.
Okay. Billy Lee Langley.
Right. She's the one that I keep mostly in contact with.
Mm-hmm.
My Vietnamese friend that lives here in Edmonds,
mm-hmm.
Nguyen Hy Van, I see he and his wife, gets up for Christmas cards with a few other people. That's
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great.
Yeah.
Just stopped too. No, it's still running. But anyway, why don't we call it a session?
All right.
And, there's a couple questions I want to ask you about some, addresses and things.